Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Welcome to episode 121 of TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined by my friend, co-host, and THR's great chief TV critic, Dan Feinberg. Hi, Dan.
How are you doing, Leslie? How are you holding up? I know that this is probably the most difficult stretch of the entire calendar for you. Did you survive Upfronts week, or are you currently a hologram?
I'm both. I survived and I'm a hologram. I don't know. I'm good. You know, there's no CW presentation today. That's coming up next week. Everything was virtual. So getting to watch that with a puppy on my lap and from the comfort of my own home, hard to beat.
Definitely not having to, for example, go to a 6 a.m. Upfront presentation at Universal NBC is a definite positive. So maybe don't return to all of the old ways in the future, broadcast networks. Maybe.
Yes. But how about that Friends reunion trailer, huh? That got me pretty excited. That was neat to see it, you know, leading off or wrapping up, I should say, the Warner Media Upfront presentation.
I definitely watched it, and it definitely looks like it will be a Friends reunion. And that is what the kids have been waiting for many a moon now, so I'm sure we'll be talking much more about that in the week to come.
That's a good cryptic teaser for next week's episode, Dan. I like what you did there.
We've got the entire cast of Friends on next week's podcast, exclusive. That's a total lie. We do not have the entire cast of Friends. We couldn't even get freaking Marcel to come on the podcast. and you know that if we could have gotten Marcel on the podcast, even if Marcel doesn't really make any noise, we would have had Marcel on the darn podcast.
Yeah. Well, in other news, I do want to shout out one pretty incredible story this week. Our colleague Lacey Rose sat down with Billy Porter for this week's cover story in THR. And Billy Porter opened up that and said that he is HIV positive and has been for 14 years. And it was a powerful read, and he stood in his truth, and it was I can't remember the last thing that I read that was that moving.
And Billy Porter is someone who always has been upfront and outfront and public about so much, and he's always been so exposed and open, and it, you know, was powerful to see. This is something that he hasn't been talking about previously, but also to see him doing it, and to see him doing it in this way, it's really very much worth the read.
Yeah, it's incredible. What about you, Dan? How are you holding on? You're constantly watching more TV than anybody I know.
This has been a week where I've been treading water, trying to work in the daytime and trying to watch many, many screeners at night for many, many shows. But, you know, as I've said all through this entire glorious pandemic-y thing, from my perspective, it's always better to have too much to do than too little and, you know, count blessings at every turn. So I'm doing that.
Well said. Well, what do you say we kick off the show with headlines? Getting started in casting news, Rebecca Ferguson will star in dystopian drama Wool for Apple from showrunner Graham Yost. Jeremy Irvine will play gay hero Alan Scott in Green Lantern for HBO Max and Greg Berlanti. Sara Ramirez will play a queer, non-binary character on the Sex and the City revival for HBO Max. And Netflix has found its new Wednesday Addams, tapping U alum Jenna Ortega to star in its live-action series from Tim Burton.
In new series pickups, the Vampire Diaries co-creator and TV's Top 5 guest Julie Plec will oversee an adaptation of Vampire Academy for Peacock. Seems likely.
Very on brand.
Kumail Nanjiani will play the founder of Chippendales in a limited series for Hulu. Netflix has picked up an untitled Bridgerton spinoff that will be written by Shonda Rhimes, as the flagship also plans a showrunner change for its third and fourth seasons as the streamer plots an expansion of its hit franchise, which also seems pretty much on brand.
Yes. HBO Max will celebrate the 20th anniversary of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone with a trivia competition show and a retrospective special as WarnerMedia begins to create additional value from its beloved franchise. The streamer, in other news, will also bring back Project Greenlight, this time with Issa Rae at the helm.
And in shows on the move news, Bubble CBS dramas Clarice and SEAL Team will move to the streamer Paramount Plus for their upcoming seasons. Joining them on the Viacom CBS streamer will be the long-delayed but eventually premiering second season of Evil.
And you'll hear much more about upfronts in our second topic this week. And if you're really curious, go back and check out our interview with Jenny Lumet from February in episode 107 about Clarice and how it was originally developed for streaming, but David Nevins wanted it for CBS. And now, yep, it's going to streaming. In executive news this week, Bill Abbott's former Hallmark Lieutenant Michelle Vaccari is out at Hallmark as new CEO Wanya Lucas shuffles her executive regime. And you can listen to our Thanksgiving holiday special interview with Michelle from back in episode 97 to hear about Hallmark's evolution under Wanya's reign.
In renewal news, Amazon has given an early season 2 pickup for its highly anticipated, but still yet to actually premiere, Wheel of Time adaptation. So don't think that you missed the first season or anything. And Chad will return for a second season on TBS.
And wrapping up headlines this week, Kaley Cuoco has inked a sprawling new overall deal with WarnerMedia. And you can hear more about her big plans as a producer in our interview with her from our 100th episode from December. And with all that out of the way, Dan, it's time to dive into this week's top five.
Number one,
leading off. And this is rather impressive, because if you had said, what are the chances that Upfronts Week would not be the number one topic on our podcast in Upfronts Week, I'd have said, you crazy. But no, it takes a large, large news story to take the number one spot away from Upfronts. And there is one. We are starting this week with the massive landscape shifting merger news that everyone's been talking about without necessarily actually knowing anything. AT&T will spin off its media and entertainment assets and merge them with Discovery in a deal that is said to be worth, dun dun dun, $43 billion. So basically, Leslie, tell us what we actually do know at this moment, because we're not really going to have a concrete resolution to this, apparently, for a year. So there's just going to be a lot of speculation for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a holding pattern. This is kind of what we saw with Disney and Fox, where it's going to have to clear regulatory hurdles before it gets the approval. So it's a holding game until then. But what we do know is that the companies have said in a press call that the merger will create a, quote, global leader in entertainment. And in a more telling statement that basically in a nutshell explains the why behind the deal is it'll create a stronger competitor in global streaming. So in a larger sense, what does this mean? It means that after regulatory hurdles likely to come, the approval is likely to come in 2022. Discovery's David Zaslav will take the leader in unscripted programming at Discovery and now add a massive vault of intellectual property, including Warner Brothers film and TV libraries, including all things DC Comics and Harry Potter and Game of Thrones and the like, and Warner Media assets, including HBO and streamer HBO Max, and lead a combined entity as CEO. So these are two companies that complement one another. So when you think of scripted programming and streaming, HBO Max has made a lot of inroads in the last year since it launched. It's got a lot of buzzy programs, and even more than that, it's got a huge amount of library, and a lot of it is scripted. The thing that they really don't have is a lot of unscripted stuff. So yes, they have, WarnerMedia owns big unscripted tentpoles like The Voice, for example, but Discovery is by far the leader in unscripted and lifestyle programming. So it's taking all of those Discovery brands and combining them together with WarnerMedia assets. And it's going to create basically this media conglomerate that together will basically provide scale. So think about it this way. You know, everyone needs assets, right? And if you look at how Viacom and CBS remerged a few years ago, and look at how Disney buying Fox assets and what that meant that Disney was able to do, this is basically the why behind the deal. So when everything is said and done, you are going to have a combined company with Discovery and WarnerMedia that will be bigger than Netflix and bigger than NBC Universal and behind only Disney as the second largest media company in the United States. So just let that sink in for a second. The second largest media company in the US. So, and bigger than Netflix. And this is, like I said, these are two brands that, that complement one another. And this is exactly why everyone is doing this. It's why Amazon is reportedly in talks to acquire MGM and its library. You need content and you need scale. And that's why you're seeing more of these mergers happen. And that's why Disney bought Marvel. That's why Disney bought Fox assets. And that's why everyone is hunting for IP and these big world franchises because they need to own their content. And like I always say on this show, Dan, and you know, like if you take nothing away from our podcast, chances are the answers to whatever you're looking for is either going to be money and an IP. And in this case, this is both. So that's where we are right now.
You are definitely taking this, though, as much more of a positive than a lot of the media reports were taking it when the news began.
I'm not taking it as a positive or okay. a negative because there is a lot. I mean, I'm interrupting you here, Dan, but the thing that is going to be insane is this is AT&T basically saying, yeah, we shouldn't have bought Time Warner and we don't want to be in the media and entertainment business. And it's also obviously after an incredibly fraught year that saw CEO Jason Kilar come in under John Stankey, the AT&T CEO, and say, we're going to shake things up. We're going to release these movies day and date in theaters and on streaming. And he just pissed off a lot of Hollywood top producers and stars. And he completely upended the whole industry. And then he pushed out two seasoned television executives in Bob Greenblatt and Kevin Reilly. And now this is basically AT&T saying, yeah, whoops. That's an expensive whoops. And at the same time, look at all how people and more at Warner Media, look at how that the face of the entire company has changed. Longtime executives, you know, Richard Plepler gone. Like no one, I never thought that there would be a world in which Plepler wasn't at HBO. He is an institution. He built that network and gone. He's got an overall deal at Apple, right? You know, think of all the people, the staffers who have weathered the turmoil under AT&T, all the executive realignments, all the firings, all the different people, you know, it's just, it's a complete cultural change for WarnerMedia under AT&T. And now it's like what we've been through, Dan, in the last couple of years with THR changing ownership a few times. So, you know, that's never a fun process. It certainly hasn't been for any of us. And, you know, on a bigger scale, think of it, That's how you can think of it, you know, for Warner Media. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely it's important to get that perspective because this is from the AT&T perspective, a large failure or let's just say they tried something that didn't work, however you want to put it. They tried something that didn't work, and in the process of it not working, they laid off thousands of people. You know, you talked about the institutions at these places that they laid off, but they also laid off a lot of people who were simply employees and, you know, who didn't get the no doubt large exit packages that someone like Richard Plepler got. So, yeah, this is something where AT&T tried to do something very ambitious, and fairly soon after they tried doing it, they're backing down and no longer attempting to do that. And it's obviously something ambitious that's coming up now, but also putting the whole thing in charge of David Zaslav pretty much says what we were doing and the people who were doing it weren't necessarily working. Let's get someone different in there. Yeah, this is a large shakeup, and it's a large shakeup that undoes the work of a previous large shakeup. I think the thing you mentioned about Amazon and MGM, which hasn't happened and is still in the rumor stage, we are maybe, and we've been talking about this now for 2 years, you know, what is happening with the world of disparate streamers and all of these different countries? When is there going to be some condensing? This may be the moment at which you start seeing condensing. This may be the moment at which, if you got all excited about Discovery Plus a couple months ago when it premiered, and HBO Max, and HBO Max now with ads and all of that. Maybe some of these things are going to start coming together, which in the long run, maybe will be convenient and helpful for the customers. But as we also say every week, it's not really about you. If it's more convenient for the customers, that is a happy accident.
Yeah. And the other, you know, piece that we should talk about is, you know, Zaslav told reporters this week that the combined company would spend $20 billion on content. That's far more than any of the big spending streamers. And it also opens up spending for HBO and HBO Max and Warner Media at a time when they had kind of been under a cash crunch under AT&T. And, you know, I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, Dan, but this shit's, it's expensive to make programming. It's expensive to lure top producers and top showrunners and sign overall deals and compete when everyone else is trying to scale up and race for IP and et cetera. So when you've got, you know, a company like HBO and HBO Max that is trying desperately to remain competitive and remain as a front runner in the content and streaming wars, and they're under a cash crunch under AT&T, and now you've got someone coming in going, yeah, we're going to spend $20 billion on content. Yeah, that's a game changer. And, you know, the other piece that, you know, it will be interesting to see is Zaslav really has no relationships with anyone in the scripted community and is going to have his work cut out for him trying to repair talent relations after Jason Kilar kind of upended Hollywood with, you know, the day and date move. So as for Kilar, yeah, sources say tell the Hollywood Reporter's Kim Masters and the New York Times are all reporting that Kilar's already negotiating his exit. So again, yeah, just what a roll of the dice and a complete crapshoot. So,
and we will spend probably some portion of the next year discussing new things as we know them.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that brings us up to what under any other circumstances surely would have been our number one story of the week. Instead, coming in at number two.
Number two.
Oh yeah, upfronts. But honestly, and let's be completely honest, when we both started with this, this was the week of weeks. This was everything. Everybody was trying to find out about all their favorite bubble shows, and everybody was speculating on what TV shows would be put on what night and who would get what lead in. And as friend of the podcast, Preston Beckman, would be quick to tell us, lead-ins do still matter even in 2021. And they do. Let's not pretend they don't. On the other hand, and we're going to talk about this, NBC did its upfront presentation on Monday, and I don't know that they mentioned what night of the week anything is going to air, and that's kind of strange. Leslie, let's start with the biggest question of all. Do upfronts still mean anything?
I mean, for press this year, I don't know how much they really meant. You're right. NBC didn't unveil its schedule during its presentation. ABC also didn't unveil a schedule. The fall schedule for CBS was an afterthought as part of Viacom CBS's presentation. Some of the big conglomerates didn't even bother to showcase trailers for their new shows. You know, this past week and the presentations were less about broadcast networks for most of them and more about the power of their portfolio. You know, when you start with NBC Universal, they really set the tone. You know, in previous years, they would, you know, divide their presentation into here's what we've got at NBC, and they would trot out a network exec, and then here's cable brand number one, here's cable brand number two, and so forth. And this year, that didn't happen because, as we've mentioned for the past year, you know, NBC Universal restructured. They now have an executive regime with Frances Berwick and Susan Rovner overseeing the entire content portfolio of NBC, Peacock, and the six cable networks. And this year, their upfront presentation was not about which platforms, but it was divided by scripted and unscripted and sports and specials and so forth. And it was less about the power of the network and more about the power of their entire portfolio. Disney had a very similar strategy, except they put out their brands first and they trotted out exec after exec. Here's John Landgraf, here's Craig Erwick talking about ABC and Hulu, and here's Tara Duncan talking about Freeform and the diversity and inclusion, the Onyx Collective that she now oversees, and here's the head of ESPN, and here's everybody else. And, you know, obviously there's no Disney Plus because Disney Plus doesn't have any ads, so it had no place in the upfronts. But it's basically like the networks were an afterthought, you know? So it's really, you know, Viacom CBS was the same way. You know, like I said, CBS, I remember, you know, the days of Les Moonves on stage going, let's take you through Monday. Here's, we're going to take you through Tuesday, and here's this show, and here's this trailer. No trailers on CBS. We scroll down at the end of the virtual CBS presentation, and, you know, there's a little note, you know, on the website. A little note on the website is like, for more on our shows, you know, look, you know, scroll down. So I scroll down, and I'm like, what is this? There's like footage of Halo for Paramount Plus, which they didn't screen. Like, they didn't showcase that during the virtual, like, holy shit, you know? And it's like, yes, of course, Paramount Plus, there's no ads. So why would they, you know, showcase that? But then why is that out there? But why didn't they not release it? You know, and it's like, it's crazy. And I've never seen a year with this much change at the upfronts. But it's also, honestly, it's not unexpected after the year that we just went through.
It's funny because they're really, you know, the streaming wars didn't really just start last week. Nor did they start when the TV's Top 5 podcast started. But there was still several years where, like I would say five solid years, where you could sense that the shift was taking place to both streamers and to cable, and where the message of upfronts was, no, seriously, networks, broadcast networks in particular, are still the number one place for, well, certainly for your advertising buck, but really just to work with advertisers. We want to be with you. We're still relevant. We're the biggest way to make the biggest splash with the biggest number of people. And that was even dramatically reduced this year. You know, that was definitely the thing that Fox was putting out there. That was the thing that Fox was repeating.
I mean, look, you want to talk about Fox for a second. You know, you've got Charlie Collier, the perennial salesman, out there pitching Tubi, right? Like, well, I mean, yes, it's an ad-supported streaming service, but like, that's, to me, that's your biggest example of the shift that we've seen. He's out there and he's saying, you know, come to Fox. We're nimble. We're small. We're, you know, we don't have a studio. We, you know, they have, you know, they're rebuilding themselves from the ground up as an independent network, et cetera. We've got Tubi. Free is important, you know, and he came up with this term. I'm sure it's, I don't know if he came up with it, but he used, you know, he goes, he pitched Fox and Tubi as the alternative to ad buyers who were struggling with what he called Max Plus syndrome, which, yeah, that's a keeper term for me. But yeah, and you know, as we're talking about how little the broadcast networks have seemed to matter to, as part of these presentations, look no further than Warner Media's presentation. And at the tail end of it, you've got the execs out there saying, or Jason Kilar out there, of course, you know, which is in a pre-taped a bit, out there unveiling HBO Max's ad-supported offering for $10 a month launching in June. You know, and normally this would be the week where people are buzzing, like, oh, this new show looks great, or how, you know, like the Wonder Years, everyone's talking about it, like the trailer looked great and Queens looks fun. But the buzziest trailer that came out this week, Dan, we talked about it at the top of the show, was for a show that's an unscripted reunion special that's going to air on a streaming platform, and for a show that ended 17 years ago.
It all feels strange, or it feels strange for us because we're so accustomed to the old normal. And so Fox kept repeating over and over again, nothing is on paywall. We've got a commercial load. Seriously.
We're nimble. Yeah, drink every time Charlie Collier said nimble.
And by nimble, he just means we've got commercial breaks. So, and we're willing to put your commercials wherever you want them, and we're willing to work with you. However, seriously, please come give us your ad money. We're nimble. Yes. Such an odd and amusing, and let's put it frankly, vaguely desperate, because that's just what everyone is. I'm not saying Fox specifically vaguely desperate. I'm saying all the broadcast networks, there is a certain desperation. I would even say, you know, the highlight of the upfronts process is always when Jimmy Kimmel gets up and roasts ABC. And it's always a good-natured but harsh piece of ribbing. I would say this year in particular, and you can go see our colleague James Hibbard's summary of the jokes he was making, I would say there was nothing good-natured about his ribbing this year. I think this year Kimmel may have gone over the edge into simple nihilism with his routine. It was like, okay, what are we all doing here? we're a floating dead whale corpse. And that's not necessarily the message that the broadcast networks have been trying to put out there for, say, 50 years.
And he's also not wrong.
Oh, no. You know. So. But he still has all, you know, he would always do the good-natured joking about, ha, 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 their shows are ridiculous, our shows are ridiculous, everything's ridiculous, give us our money, give us your money. This year, I'm not even sure there was any kind of justification for any of it other than this is a strange relic of a past industry that we're attempting to perpetuate out here yearly. Isn't it weird that we're still doing this? Honestly, I always find it kind of funny how he tiptoes along that line every year. This year, he was just way on the other side of the line. It was hilarious as a result. But if I'm an advertiser sitting in there, at some point at the beginning, I'm going, ha, 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 he's joking about our business. And then after about 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, dear Lord, is it time for me to go back to law school? And that, you know, probably is not is not a complete success.
Right. But at the same time, you know, the thing that I think, you know, it's important to note right now is, yeah, you know, you can make fun of, you know, like, oh, does broadcast still matter, you know, in 2021? And the answer is yes, because when you look at a show, as several execs have told me in the last week, and some I think may have even said on stage, I don't know, it's all kind of a blur at this point, but all these broadcast shows are going to wind up on streaming platforms where they are going to get a completely additional audience. You know, you've got Craig Erwick out there talking about Grey's Anatomy. And that's a great example. That show is tied with This Is Us is the number one drama on broadcast. But then it airs the next day on Hulu, where it gets a completely different audience of possible cord cut, you know, people who cut the cord, and you're basically doubling the audience, right? And that's, you know, everything that's on broadcast winds up on a streaming platform, whether it's the next day or a couple of months down the road. So eventually that line will blur and it won't matter. You know, we've seen for a long time, people don't necessarily know where some of these shows originate. You know, like lots of people I see on social talking about Cruel Summer and like, oh, it's on Hulu. No, it's not. It's on Freeform. You know, like that happens all the time. I remember being at TCA years ago and David Nevins telling reporters, I don't know if this was during a presentation or in a scrum afterwards. And he was saying how upset he was that most people thought Shameless, which was their number one drama on Showtime, was a Netflix original because that's where people watched it. That's what's happening. That's what will continue to happen. And that's why you're seeing all these companies shift, saying we don't necessarily need to put CBS front and center. We're going to put our entire ecosystem front and center, and you can buy an ad on CBS and it'll, you know, be across a lot of the cable networks, and NBC Universal is doing the exact same thing. And you know, Disney's got an ad-supported version of Hulu, et cetera, and plus ABC in Freeform. Eventually, that's where everyone's going to go, and it's just a bigger question of how soon until all of these presentations are focused on the one central ecosystem.
So let's get to a couple pieces of the actual news: the cancellations, renewals, transfers to Paramount Plus, et cetera, et cetera. Give us a couple of the things that surprised you this week.
Well, just about the surprises, to me, the biggest one is Rebel. And yes, I do think Krista Vernoff is incredibly talented and as a showrunner and a writer. And while I haven't seen Rebel, I will say she is ABC's most valued producer running Grey's and Station 19. Obviously, you know, rebuilding Grey's to broadcast number one drama is a big deal. That season had a hell of a year creatively. She got both Grey's and Station 19 and Rebel up during a pandemic, and they canceled Rebel, which was her first original show that managed to get on the air after 13 attempts. And they canceled it after 5 episodes. This was like incredible. And they owned it. They owned the show, and they still gave it a quick hook because, you know, Craig Erwick says not enough people watched it on linear, and they looked at the digital trends and it just wasn't trending in the right direction. Sources say ABC Signature is going to try and shop the show elsewhere. But that to me is it's stunning because you own the show. It's from your biggest producer. It's perfectly on brand for ABC, inspired by Aaron Brockovich, starring Katie Sagal. It's a great cast with Andy Garcia and John Corbett. And again, from Krista, and that's surprising. And, you know, for Life, the decision to cancel that at ABC, you know, you've got an incredibly timely show with a big producer like 50 Cent attached to it. But that was a show that was originally championed by Carrie Burke, who's now at running 20th For Life is produced by ABC Signature. Yes, still part of the Disney fold, but I hear that that's being shopped and could wind up at Hulu, which would surprise me because Craig Erwick oversees both. So why would he cancel one thing on ABC and pick it up on the other thing that he also oversees? But those are the big, you know, to me, Rebel is the biggest surprise in terms of the cancellations. In terms of pilot passes, I was shocked to see Ways and Means not make the cut simply because Patrick Dempsey, you know, the interest in him has obviously changed a lot since his big surprise return to Grey's Anatomy this past season. But it was a political drama. And I think what we've seen in our landscape is people are not really wanting to live in that space right now after the past couple of years that we've had. And, you know, what I'm getting from a lot of studio chiefs as part of my annual survey this year is people are shifting to uplifting programming. You know, they don't want to watch stuff that's too heavy. And that's honestly, that's what you and I have been talking about in terms of my own personal viewing habits. So, and I don't think I'm alone. And everyone that I talk to is basically saying the same thing. You know, it's very hard to watch stuff that's too stark of a reminder. Let's see, what else? I think the big, you know, move of Clarice to Paramount Plus is hilarious because, you know, you can go back and listen to our Jenny Lumet interview, and she talked extensively about how much she and Alex Kurtzman wanted to make this show for streaming in the first place and how David Nevins pushed incredibly hard and sold them and convinced them to make it for CBS. And yeah, they were right the first time. So that was interesting. And then in terms of scheduling, Dick Wolf has 9 shows on the fall schedule. 9 shows, controlling 3 full nights of prime time across 2 different networks with 3 different Law and Order shows, 3 different Chicago shows, and 3 different FBI shows. And that is what we call a reliance on franchises. And then you've got CSI coming back in the fall on CBS with the flagship, you know, where it's reuniting with Survivor, which 2 shows that were originally paired more than a decade ago. Yeah, it's really surprising. So let's see what else. All Rise getting the hook. A lot has been written about the behind the scenes turmoil there. I wasn't surprised to see that. But then a show like Be Positive with a star that's also had some allegations against him. That's returning.
Or CBS has been perfectly happy to renew Bull over and right. over and over again. So, you know, look, CBS, we know what matters at CBS, and CBS has never pretended about what matters. So quite simply, if All Rise had the ratings that apparently Bull has, it would still be back because...
Right, but apparently they clean house at All Rise, and it's still one of a few shows on CBS specifically that has a black lead. So,
oh, no, I understand why it would have been smart or optically beneficial for them to have kept it on, but, you know, they decided that was not the thing that mattered. I'm still flummoxed that Bull keeps coming back, but CBS knows what the value of that is, and they don't care what I think, and that's totally fine. They're doing just fine on their bottom line without caring what Dan thinks.
Yeah, but, you know, in a larger sense, you know, the total volume of new series pickups is at 25 right now. That is up from the pandemic anomaly of last year, but not quite at the pre-pandemic volume of 2019. We still have the CW to go. They're expected to announce their fall schedule and new series pickups next week. They're expanding to Saturday, so I'm curious if the volume will increase at the network because they've got a couple of pilots. I'm expecting Powerpuff Girls and Naomi to get the green light. They've already picked up the 4400, and then they've got a few different backdoor pilots that aired as planted episodes. So I'm curious how much they'll continue to pick up, and then we can get into more of what other decisions are still left to be determined in our next segment. But yeah, in terms of, you know, the other stuff, no real surprises. Fox bringing back both 911s, The Residents coming back, The Great North got an early third season. The network also got an early jump on the 22-23 broadcast season and picked up a show called Accused from the powerhouse trio of Homeland creators Howard Gordon, Alex Gonza, and House creator David Shore, who's currently on The Good Doctor for ABC. CBS is returning both of its Chuck Lorre comedies and picked up a Pete Holmes bowling comedy and Sophia Bush medical drama called Good Sam. ABC picked up The Wonder Years and Queens and Maggie and Abbott Elementary. And I got to say, the trailers for Wonder Years and Queens and even Abbott look really great to me. Gone from ABC's lineup is American Housewife, Call Your Mother, and Mixed Ish. Blackish is officially returning for an 8th and final season, joining the Connors, the Goldbergs, the rookie comedy Home Economics, and A Million Little Things. And NBC, to no surprise, we talked about Dick Wolf having three Law and Order shows, is bringing back organized crime. And, you know, the other shocker, I think, of the week is, and it started Monday, so it feels like less of it a week later, but the network is holding back all comedy from its fall schedule for the first time in more than 50 years. But then you've got Brooklyn Nine-Nine coming back in August. So it's kind of that in-between lead-in after the, you know, ahead of the fall season or leading into the fall season. So,
okay, take a deep breath now, and we're going to move on to our next topic, which you already just teased. And I would go so far as to say you probably gave the kids about a third of the topic, because for number three, we're going to...
Number three.
What's still to come after Upfronts Week? So what is still up in the air, Leslie? Again, take a deep breath, because you are doing a lot of heavy lifting this week.
Well, don't worry, man. You're coming up next. You're anchored a great interview coming up in our showrunner spotlight. But still to be determined, I just talked about the CW having decisions left to make. They still have Republic of Sarah yet to premiere. That's, I believe, in June. Fox's animated comedy, Housebroken, yet to premiere, but the fate of all of its current pilots have been decided. NBC is where it's got a lot of action. They have Bubble shows Good Girls and Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist and Manifest and Rookie Debris all on the bubble. Sources say Good Girls could move to Netflix as an original, with Zoe's possibly landing on Peacock. The latter is a part of a renegotiation with co-producers Lionsgate. Then you've got the pilot side. It's interesting. You know, I wrote a big feature about how the pandemic forced the broadcast networks to change in terms of its development model. And NBC, I think, is the poster child for that and for the year-round pilot development and ditching the idea of picking up 60 to 90 different pilots and producing them all in a three-month window. So NBC has a mix of holdovers from 2020, as well as a few recently ordered pilots, including comedies Crazy for You, the Demi Lovato comedy Hungry. It's Jim Jeffries' comedy that's been in the works for a while. The Night Court revival, the rom-com Someone Out There, as well as dramas At That Age, Dangerous Moms, Echo, Getaway, and a procedural from Julie Plec. You know, NBC really hasn't made decisions about its midseason lineup, so you can expect some decisions on those four bubble shows, as well as some pilots in the months to come. I'm personally going to be interested to see how much of their remaining pilot slate will be for 21-22 or even afterwards, because that's honestly where I think we are as an industry. You know, the pandemic really effectively wiped out pilot season last year. So this season has been a mix of holdovers and newly ordered stuff in the past couple of months. And I'm curious if pilot seasons to come will continue to be a mix of things that we've seen developed for months or even years at this point. And yeah, I think it's a smart idea, because I don't know, you know, and these networks have been talking for a long time, Dan, about, is pilot season dead? You know, I wrote in the story, you know, Kevin Reilly was right. And it's time that he gets credit for coming out in 2014 and saying on the TCA stage when he was still president of Fox and saying RIP pilot season. He was right. He was right. Fox just picked up two shows straight to series with Fantasy Island and The Accused. You know, doing year-round development makes sense. You're not competing for the same talent and directors and production space and cast members all at the same time, and trying to make a product that is going to be sold worldwide in 3 months. That's insane. But anyway, I digress. So shifting over to ABC, they still have a couple of late season pilot orders still in contention, including the Disney-themed fairy tale drama Epic, the political drama Dark Horse, and the Kevin Costner-produced National Parks investigation, plus Latinx family drama Promised Land and 2020 holdover Triage. Sources say all of those remain in contention for midseason or beyond. So, yeah. And then CBS still has True Lies, which was moved off cycle almost immediately after it scored a pilot order early a couple of months ago. So lots still to come. I expect obviously the total volume of 25 will grow once we hear from CW. But yeah, it's going to start to be incredibly hard to do these big by the numbers crunches, because we seem like we're finally in a year round development model. So lots going on, still so much stuff still happening. But yeah, it's this year has been fascinating to see how these networks have had to evolve and how they will continue to do so in the years to come.
And once again, stay tuned for more details on all of that and or more. Up next is our Showrunner Spotlight segment.
Number four.
Our guest this week is Alan Yang, the Emmy-winning co-creator of Master of None, whose credits include NBC's The Office, Parks and Recreation, and The Good Place, as well as Amazon's Forever. The Netflix comedy, which has not aired since 2017, returns this weekend for its third season with Lena Waithe's Denise front and center. Thank you for joining us, Alan.
Thanks for having me, guys. Good to talk to you.
So it's been 4 years, is that right, since season two ended, and the show is back with a season that is, starting with the premiere, very different. Take us through the discussions to bring it back for a third season and to refocus it around Lena Waithe's character, Denise.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, you saying 4 years just made me just think about life. It's like 4 years. Wow, that seems like a long time. Very standard in the world of television, right? You take that 4 year break. No, you know, it's funny. You know, people have asked kind of like, yeah, what was behind the decision? And quite honestly, it's something we had talked about for a surprisingly long time. You know, ever since season one, really, we did an episode season one called Mornings, which was about Dev and Rachel and their relationship and about their mornings together as a couple. And we were already curious, like, what's Denise's mornings like? Like, what would that character look like? And then, of course, season two, we did the Thanksgiving episode, which really centered Denise. And, you know, it just, I think the watchword for our show, for Master, is really, what's the most exciting idea? What's the most challenging thing? And honestly, what's something that scares us a little bit? So I think taking a swing like this was like, you know, we talked about, okay, there's a version of this that's a love story, that's an intimate, you know, sort of real deep sort of exploration of a relationship. And yeah, there's a version of it with Aziz's character, and maybe it's Dev and a woman and it's a straight couple, but we kind of felt like, this is more interesting. Like, you know, centering Denise and Alicia and exploring this relationship felt like applying a lot of these classic film techniques that we love, but to a super, super modern 2021 couple. And so that was one of the guiding principles, and that was one of the things that really excited us.
So after season two ended, Aziz has said that he wasn't sure that Master would be back for another season because he had nothing else to say about being a young single guy living and eating around New York City. So a few months later, obviously, he was accused of sexual assault and immediately apologized. How much of the decision to pivot to Denise was based on Aziz not wanting to be in the spotlight of the new season?
I don't think that was really the issue. I mean, it was really something like we creatively were really excited about. And, you know, we had some of these ideas pre-season two, really. So it was really us talking about these scripts and these ideas. I mean, man, when we really started getting into the scripts, I was working on a movie I did called Tiger Tail. And so Aziz started working on these scripts. And, you know, obviously then we brought Lena into the process because, you know, it's her character being centered. So, you know, it really wasn't about him not wanting to be in it. In fact, we have other, you know, I don't think I'm even supposed to say this, but we have some other ideas and other scripts where Aziz is in it. And honestly, this season was shootable during COVID, and some of the other scripts we had were not shootable. So we actually had some other scripts where Aziz was in them and we couldn't shoot them due to COVID. So it really wasn't that. It was more like this was really creatively more exciting and seemed like just, as you said, a more interesting pivot to us.
But was there a conscious awareness of sort of where the discourse might have been otherwise? I mean, you guys are out in the world of the internet as much as anyone, you know, just sort of making sure that the third season could stand on its own in a different way.
I think it's important that the third season's able to stand on its own. By the way, Aziz is not in the internet, so he's barely out there at all. I think he now refuses to like use a smartphone, so he like doesn't have email or anything. So he's gone back to just like, you know, like call me on a landline or whatever. No, that's not right. But it literally like the dude does not use emails, which is really, really fun for me. But no, it's funny. It's just like for us, it's like making the thing and just making sure that the thing is something we're proud of, and that's really all you can do. I mean, I'm happy to do promotions and press and stuff like this, but ultimately, like to us, it's like let's work really hard on making this thing as good as we can make it, and hopefully people respond to it.
But along those lines, there are multiple Dev appearances in the season. What were the conversations like about how much Dev you wanted to have to make this feel like Masters of None versus at what point does it cease to be Denise's story, since that's what you wanted to tell?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we centered Denise. So there's, you know, interesting aspects of these dev scenes where it's really about what happens when you become successful and what happens to your life. And one of those aspects is what happens to your relationship. Another is what happens to your family. And another is what happens to your friendships and the friendships you made maybe before you became successful. And so that was something that was on our minds the whole time. And there were definitely versions of the script where we're like, maybe there's no dev. And it's like, whoa, wouldn't it be cool if he's not in the season at all? Like, I actually was pushing for that for a while, just creatively. It's like, it is really bold. And then we're like, you know, it's probably somewhat of an olive branch to extend to the audience to like have the main character of your show appear a couple times. So as challenging as the season is in some ways, and as much as we want to sort of challenge people's preconceptions of what another season of a television show could be, we were like, yeah, I think it's fun to see them together. And I think those scenes are really compelling, you know, especially there's one later on in the season that is like, man, this is like, it's interesting to see this guy who, as you guys mentioned, you know, was having a great run of it and was going around New York and eating tacos and having fun. And now it's like, you know, that's not everyone's experience. And so I thought it was touching to see those two act together again.
But along those lines, and you just mentioned it, how conscious are you of audience expectations for what Master of None means as a title, and sort of giving audiences some of that just so that they aren't running off crying going, this wasn't Masters of None at all?
I think ultimately we're trying to get the word out that at least it's Denise's season, so they understand that, and that's through the poster and through the trailer. But we're hoping people are just along for the ride, you know. It's sort of like it. Television is changing so much over the course of the last five, like, as you guys said, you know, we put out the show, what, first season was 5-6 years ago. And at the time when we sold the show to Netflix, they had two shows. They had Orange is the New Black and House of the Cards. And they had also a show called Lilyhammer, which I think they had imported. But that was it. Like, when we went to pitch the show to Ted Sarandos, it was us and him in like a conference room. And like, things have changed a lot. You know, things have changed a lot. And I think in the wake of that, I like the idea that, you know, a show can evolve and change over time. And I don't know, maybe this is just our taste, but I like when creators and filmmakers challenge us and maybe don't do the same thing every time. And, you know, if you look at the greatest filmmakers, right? And not to compare us to them in any by any stretch of the imagination, but look at the different genres the Coen brothers do, right? The Coen brothers made Raising Arizona. They made Big Lebowski. Then they made No Country for Old Men, right? It's like, you can do it. You know, it's like, isn't it fun to be able to do that, right? Isn't it fun for Scorsese to make, you know, Taxi Driver and After Hours? Like, you know, that's kind of like, look, those are high aspirations, but it's also like, you know, what a fun thing. And we understand that this sort of very lucky, privileged position we're in to be able to do this, but to be able to do a season and do a slightly different tone. And it was funny because, again, we had the exact same conversation you guys are bringing up right now, which is like, oh man, it's like, it's not like Devin Arnold eating tacos, like, you know, going to Italy and like eating pasta or whatever. But we really like it, and ultimately the you know, our taste and sort of our creative instincts are all we have. You know, we can only trust what our own taste is and where our own work leads us. And so we kind of felt like, you know, let's pursue what we feel most strongly about, and hopefully the audience will follow. And then we started showing it to people, and we started showing people cuts we had, and the reaction we got from people we really trust, whose taste we really trust, was really positive. And and more than that, you know, we were saying like, oh, is it, how weird is it that it's more dramatic, and, you know, it's shot on film and the camera never moves and there's almost no close-ups and all, it's just people kind of performing, you know, in these wider shots. And the reaction we got was like, yeah, of course it's a little bit more dramatic, but there's fun moments and there's funny moments, and, you know, ideally you're portraying some representation of life, which has ups and downs, right? Which has positive moments and has sadder moments and has challenges and has triumphs, right? So, you know, that's all a very long-winded way of saying we feel lucky to be able to do this, and we're grateful to Netflix Universal for reading these scripts and saying, yes, this is something we're interested in doing, and taking that leap and doing something that we feel like is probably the most mature thing we've ever made, and we're very proud of.
A quick follow-up on that one, too. You know, you mentioned Netflix and Universal, obviously the producers on that in the studio. But did you have to repitch the season? Like, was it basically like, hey, we have season three, here's what it is. And they're just like, great, when do you want to premiere it? When can you deliver? Or was it like, hey, we're kind of throwing out our playbook, doing something different? Like, what was the reaction when you came to them with this?
You might be surprised. We were like, we had to prep them. We got to call them and talk to them about what we're doing and send them the scripts. But quite frankly, we wrote all the scripts kind of before any of this happened. Like, before we even really pitched it, we kind of just wrote them, right? That's kind of how we operate. We just kind of, that's how we did season one and two, is like, you know, a lot of it was just us writing stuff and getting to shoot them. And so for this season, we kind of just worked on the scripts and wrote them, and then we called our partners over there. And again, we were, you know, by the way, every other showrunner in the world is hating us right now, but because we were saying, yeah, they just let us do it. But we were, you know, they were pretty cool about it, and we called them, and it's always just been a good sort of partnership over there with Ted and now Bella and Andy Weil, who's been working on the show since season one. You know, we just have a working understanding with them, and they're open-minded. And we talked to Andy has seen every classic film in the world, right? He's seen every play, he has great taste in our opinion. And he knew, you know, when we talked about whatever highfalutin references like Ingmar Bergman or Chantal Ackerman or Yasujirō Ozu or anything, he was like, oh, I get it. Like, I get it. And like, that's really lucky, you know. Shout out to Andy. Cause that is a thing where like a lot of, you know, I think a lot of venues, a lot of networks might've been like, what are you guys doing? But he kind of saw the vision, and we sent them the scripts, and we did an epic, you know, 4-hour long table read over Zoom, and it played really well. And I think, you know, when we cast Naomi, something else got unlocked that was really magical, and the chemistry and the interplay between the two of them was something really special. So, you know, was it probably a curveball they didn't expect? Yes, but I can only express gratitude to them for allowing us to make this, and by the way, make this under the sort of restrictions of COVID in the UK, you know. So we shot this in the UK and of course presented all of its own difficulties doing COVID shooting. But again, it's a minor miracle that I think that the cast and crew pulled it off.
Yeah, I want to come back to the COVID and the logistics of it all. Sure. In a minute. But before we get to that, so you've talked about about Netflix and Universal's reaction. Now I'm curious, you know, in this landscape, as we talk about how much it's changed, especially since season two debuted, it's really challenging for shows to retain viewers when they're off the air for so long. A 4-year gap. I mean, I don't even think Game of Thrones did that. But how much do you guys hope the new season appeals to viewers who haven't seen the show before, while also trying to kind of update fans on the first two seasons with what's happened to these two characters and where they are now?
That's actually a huge discussion we've had. And look, our brightest scenario, our best case scenario, by the way, love the Game of Thrones thing. It's like, man, they need to do it. Now you're scaring me, Leslie. Don't do that to me. We don't have Game of Thrones numbers to fall back on, I don't think. I have to talk to Netflix, but I'm pretty sure we didn't have 50 million people watching. But no, it's, you know, it's definitely a conversation we had. And look, this is our hope. This is the best case scenario, is fans who enjoyed the show in the past will check it out. Right, we'll check it out based on the strength of the show and the brand name of the show. And by the way, maybe some of them have gotten a little bit older and matured. And by the way, the climate of the country and the world is a little different from how it was 4 years ago in a lot of ways. So maybe in some ways this season suits the climate a little better and is a little bit more sober and a little bit, you know, more aware of what's going on. And then secondarily to that, it's exactly like you said. I think we've talked specifically with Netflix about, you know, why not try feeding the show to people who are watching some more dramatic stuff and people who've been watching, you know, romantic stuff and things that are a little bit more grounded and a little bit less comedic. You know, fans of Lena and fans of Naomi and fans of, you know, people who may not have checked out the first two seasons very well might enjoy the season. So I think that's the hope, right? And you never know. Obviously, I think we have some other fun ideas we'd have for future seasons. So who knows what will happen. But I think the goal is, look, hopefully people like it. Hopefully there's good word of mouth. And it's like, yeah, check this out. It's different from the earlier seasons, but there's something really compelling and there's something that I haven't seen before. You know, that's another thing we talked about a lot, which is between seasons one and two, like, let's try to challenge people. And you know, like with season one, we try to challenge them with the parents episode and try to show them something they hadn't seen before with season two, you know, whether it's Thanksgiving or New York, I Love You or some of those episodes. It's like, let's try to do things we hadn't seen as much on TV. And by the way, in the ensuing 4 years, as you mentioned, there's been an explosion of radical experimental television, some of it quite excellent. And so we kind of feel like, okay, we got to keep setting the bar higher and give them something else that they haven't seen before. And hopefully we've come close.
I want to go back to the highfalutin references because
that's right, man after my own heart, Daniel.
Because let me say, there's nothing that's going to get people to watch like saying it's very, very Bergman inspired.
Get those numbers right. The Game of Thrones guys are shaking in their boots. They're like, our ratings records are in jeopardy.
and I feel like there's no question that. The people who know are going to know the Bergman references. And I feel like there are a lot of other things that are sort of, you know, in the background things, whether it's Two for the Road or something like that. What else do you want to point to as the texts that people might want to be aware of if they're going to be completely on the vibe of this season?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to spoil them all. And first of all, I also want to remind listeners that at its core, this is a love story. I assure you, at least you can try to take my word for it. You know, I showed it to my girlfriend who has no interest in those films personally. She's a big Julie Roberts, you know, rom-com fan, which is totally awesome. Those movies are totally awesome. But she was like, no, I was like, were you bored? She was like, no, I just immediately got into just this relationship. And look, she's biased, but she was like, I would tell you if it were too slow or whatever. But she was like, I just immediately cared about Denise and Alicia. And that is ultimately all we want to do as people making a show, people making a movie, whatever. It's like, do you care about the characters? Do you care about their story? Do you care about their relationship? Do you care? Do you believe these people are real? Do you believe they're in love? Do you believe they're on the rocks? Like, all of these things, that was what was important to us, regardless of how you're shooting the movie, where the camera is, what film stock you're using, any of that. All that stuff's fun, right? Those are all tools. What you really want is like, man, are you capturing these actors' charisma? Do you buy these characters, and are you invested in the story? And to us, like, we felt like it was proof of concept when we started watching those early cuts. We started watching, you know, after a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks or so, we watched just some of the assemblies of the scenes we had shot just to make sure that we weren't insane. So we were watching it and the choices we were making sure that they were not too off-putting or too slow or whatever. And we really felt like, wow, we care about these characters and we're invested. So, you know, a couple of the touch points, you know, obviously I mentioned Bergman and Scenes from a Marriage. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But another big one was was Jean d'Aumont, which is kind of a seminal a work by Chantal Ackerman, which is the ultimate in not moving the camera. And it wasn't like we weren't working outside in, if that makes sense. We weren't saying like, we want to do this as like a showy thing. Like, this is an example of our long one take scenes. It wasn't that. It was more like, we want to put people in this cabin. We want to make them feel like they are living this relationship with these characters. They are a fly on the wall, and you want to forget that you're watching a show. We want you to forget that you're watching filmed entertainment. We want you to feel like, I am just watching this couple in love. I'm watching them fight. I'm watching them fall in and out of love. I'm really feeling this, and I'm trying to, you know, honestly, we're trying to get rid of some of the artifice, right? One of the things we talked about was, it's almost an arms race how cutty and fast cutting, you know, everything is these days. Of course, action movies, but everything. You watch a sitcom, I can barely keep up with what, it's too fast. Like, I can't keep up. Maybe I'm getting old, but it's like, it's almost so fast when you watch, you know, a lot of modern productions. It's like, there's an edit every second, right? There's an edit every second. And we were like, what if we didn't play that game? What if we didn't take all, like, literally, you sometimes go into editing and take air out of scenes. You take air out. You're scared the audience is going to get bored. You're scared they're not going to. So you just keep taking air out. It's faster, faster, faster. And suddenly it's just a torrent of words coming from a bunch of different characters. For us, it's like, what if we go the other way and just, hey, they're talking in the scene like people talk. Like, you're just watching two people talk. Like, how revolutionary is that? And there's no way to pull the air out. And by the way, this is another, like, tightrope walk that the actors managed to do, which, you know, my girlfriend pointed out, she's an actress, and she was like, there's nowhere to hide. You know, it's just takes of people talking, and it's not, you know, this is the scene, this is the performance, and there's no editing, there's no sort of hiding or hoping you get the best takes. You're stitching together 10 takes in a scene. You're just watching the performances, and again, I was pleasantly surprised at how brilliant Naomi and Lena were.
And yet you're still playing to a certain small part of the demographic audience that's going to watch and go, ooh, it's in 4:3.
Yes, you know, and by the way, the title sequences and all that stuff, you know, look, it's those are the, you know, we're, you know, paying homage to some stuff that we love. And that's part of, you mean, look at the pillow shots, right? To me, this is the ultimate nerdy director thing to say, but it's like, I love some of the B-roll stuff we shot. Like, I love, you know, like going out and putting the camera in these locations, you know, very picturesque places, and the rhythm of them, and something as simple as a shot of a coat being hung up, or a shot of a bird in a tree, or Naomi lying on her back in the crook of a dead tree. Like, you know, those things are, you know, they give something life. They give a piece life when you add those in, you know.
Do the actors freak out, though, when you tell them there won't be close-ups?
I think they kind of loved it. I think it was like, it was weird to begin with, where they're like, oh, we're done. But here's what you really do, I think. The first thing you do is everything counts, right? Everything, every take counts. The first take might be it. You know, it might be, it's like, hey, we did it. Then you get to the rhythm of it. And obviously all these things are rehearsed. And I think Aziz did a great job of rehearsing with the actors and using those rehearsals ahead of time to put those sort of ad libs, improvisations, and in character moments into the script. So on the day we had already rehearsed. And then of course we rehearsed further on the day on set and we refined further. And then on top of that, the other bonus is, and again, this was an incredible boon during COVID, it's fast. It's incredible. We didn't shoot coverage. I mean, there are scenes, you know, we've all been there where it's like you're shooting a scene and it takes 2 days to shoot, or it takes, you know, you're shooting close-ups, mediums, wides, you know, you got to get two sizes, multiple, you know, you're blasting three cameras at something. You're shooting, you know, steady cam shot. All that stuff obviously takes time. So here with this kind of style of shooting, it's performance. And by the way, makes you think harder about your production design, your wardrobe, your hair and makeup, and your blocking. Your staging and your blocking becomes your movement. You're not moving the camera, so you better have that staging correct. You better have the blocking correct. It better feel natural, but it better have enough interest in the scene. So I think it honed a lot of Aziz's skills as a director and all of our skills sort of producing the show and writing the show and getting that stuff on point to make sure that, you know, it became a strength as opposed to a crutch or a weakness.
So now you mentioned a minute ago about the things that you were able to do during COVID and the things that the pandemic obviously derailed. Talking about all the different creative ways that the show is shot and how different that is from what you've done before, how much of that was a result of what you were able to do and what your limitations were with shooting during the pandemic?
It was in some ways a happy coincidence. And by that, I mean, you know, first of all, just doing this season, again, these scripts were written a while ago, but they happened to occur, you know, so we were going to shoot it in spring of last year. So in March of last year, I flew to London and I was in the UK and we were scouting, you know, tech scouting, trying to find locations, all that stuff. March 11th, Tom Hanks gets COVID, Rudy Gobert gets COVID, the NBA shut down, you know, Donald Trump shuts down travel. So March 12th, I fly back to LA, right? So I fly back to LA and the show shut down. We talk, you know, later in the year about starting production back up and doing what's safe and what's reasonable to do. And quite frankly, it was kind of a miracle COVID show because it was like, look, this is mostly two people in a house talking. So that alone, there's no crowd scenes, you know, very few locations. So that alone made it a COVID friendly show. And on top of that, it happened to be a story about queer Black love in a time when that was more relevant than it could ever have been, in our opinion. So we kind of had the show. It's like, this seems to make a lot of sense. We should try to shoot this in the fall, in the winter. And then on top of that, we had always intended to shoot it this way. As we said, we had watched these films and we had been inspired by the ability to make a moving story possible without moving the camera. You know, so there's something about, we had already planned to do that. And then, of course, with the difficulties of COVID, and every showrunner and director is rubbing their temples hearing this, but it's like, of course, you have contact tracing, you have testing every day, and you have potential shutdowns. When people not even testing positive, but false positives or contacts or anything like that, a driver, you know, tests positive once and then you see if it's real. So all that stuff obviously causes delays. But because we had already intended to shoot this way, and as I said, it's incredibly speedy, I don't want to misquote, but we were somehow able to shave days and days and days off the expected length of the production. So we were able to finish, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. And despite the fact that COVID makes all the days shorter and really puts a crimp in a lot of your plans, we were able to execute this season partly because of the shooting style, which, by the way, was not demanded by COVID, but was something we had planned on beforehand. So that was really fortunate in a lot of ways.
And you did say you had some scripts for the season that you wanted to do that COVID made impossible. Can you talk a little bit about what you didn't get to do and what that means for a potential fourth season?
Exactly. I don't want to spoil that because God knows if it'll ever get made, or, you know, we're always talking with our friends over at Netflix and Universal to see what's next. But, you know, whether it's a different show entirely but yes, there were some other scripts and ideas that were not so COVID friendly as two people in a beautiful cabin. So, but they were really, yeah, we were really proud of those as well. So, you know, we're incredibly excited about this season and for people to watch it. But yeah, there was other stuff in the hopper that was rendered really impossible to shoot.
I do want to go back to focusing the season on two Black and queer characters. You know, season three to me feels almost like a different show. And I say that we've talked in the past for seasons one and two, you know how much I loved those seasons, but this is obviously, it's an intimate portrait of a same-sex relationship. And Lena co-wrote the season alongside Aziz. How did the creative process compare to the first two seasons? And what did Lena really bring from her own experience in her relationships to the show?
Yeah, I mean, as you might imagine, for a much more intimate show, a much more intimate season, it was a more intimate writing process. And by that, I mean, there wasn't really a writer's room, right? So early on, it was Aziz, you know, calling me on the phone and us having phone calls and just, you know, talking about potential ideas, talking about the season, and then moving on to research. So, you know, a lot of research was done in terms of interviewing people and sort of reading books about fertility, which is something that happens later in the season. So that kind of research. But of course, we brought in Lena very early because she was centered in this season. And as far as her personal experiences, I think, you know, we tried to hew away from capturing, you know, exactly what happened to her in her personal life. We felt like, you know, we didn't want to do that exactly, but certainly her perspectives and her emotional experiences and sort of, you know, her specific experience as someone who's been in queer relationships, you know, I think we definitely used details that only she would know, and a straight Asian guy and a straight Indian guy are not going to know. So I think it was like, we got to have her help write these episodes, you know, and obviously she's an incredibly talented writer in her own right. So, you know, she was brought in really early in the process and, you know, they kind of looked at the scripts together and wrote them. And I think, you know, that experience was invaluable, but we never saw it as like a one-to-one with any of her relationships or anything like that. It was more like, wow, I mean, we need this perspective. And on top of that, you know, when Naomi was cast, it was a lot of like, well, we'd like to get your input on these characters as well. And what makes the most sense for you? Because, you know, we always try to tailor the characters to the actors. And so seasons one and two, you know, we obviously wrote Denise towards Lena and we wrote Arnold towards Eric. And it was, I mean, that's a no-brainer for us, especially coming from comedy. But even in a dramatic sense. I mean, you look at some of the greatest stuff, you know, ever made in terms of, oh, this is a romantic drama or whatever. It's like, I mean, not to cite Bergman again, of course, he did a lot of research in that sense. But, you know, you look at someone like Richard Linklater or something, right? You know, he's talking to Ethan Hawke and talking to Julie Delpy. And that's part of the reason why those, you know, the Before trilogy is so good, is like, I think he's using some of the essence of these performers. And I think you'd be kind of a fool not to. So, you know, all of that was kind of part and parcel. But the short answer of that is that it's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of phone calls between me and Aziz, me and Lena and Aziz, and just all of us chatting. And that's, you know, that was our writer's room. You know, we're talking about like Zoom writer's rooms now. It's like, you know, a lot of it was just like calls. And like, you know, Aziz was in London for some of it, and I was in LA, and Lena was in LA and in Atlanta or wherever. You know, it was just like, let's just do these phone calls and see what comes out of them and what's most interesting. And, you know, that gets put right into the show, right? Conversations we're having and what are our opinions about, honestly, life and romantic relationships and career and all that stuff. It all kind of works its way in just like it did in the past seasons.
The Before movies have the two characters that are consistent throughout, but they're also all very different tonal pieces. And I feel like the first two seasons were maybe more a romantic comedy with a bittersweet vein. This feels more bittersweet with a romantic comedy vein. Was that something you knew it was going to be when you started off, or did the bittersweetness sort of just come as you were progressing?
I love that take, Daniel. Like, can we use that for the poster? It's like it's an elegant reversal. But yeah, no, I think that's a good way of putting it. That's a good way of putting it. And I think, yeah, I think it's kind of some of the stuff I was alluding to earlier, which is like there is a little bit more somberness to this season, and it's something like, you know, it felt a little bit like that show, you know, the first two seasons were a different era of not just the country, but the world. You know, it's like one of the jokes we kind of have is like, man, you watch that show, it's like, man, that's a real like Obama era show. That's like a super, it's such an Obama era show. You know, it's optimistic. I mean, who knows if like, you know, all that's justified, but it was, you know, optimistic and sort of like happy-go-lucky and carefree. And, you know, obviously there were issues at the time, but you know, it was in terms of society, but that's how it felt. I mean, it's such an Obama era show that like Obama himself watched it and told us he liked it. So like that's the kind of like, that's how in that vein it was. But you know, a lot of shit has happened since then, and you know, it just feels like the tone of the show kind of suits where we are now. And you know, look, there's always room for escapism, and there's always room for sort of just straight up fun shows. But this season is not that. I think there's fun elements, and like you said, I think there's always a vein of like optimism and sort of warmth that seeps into our shows. And I think both of us, Aziz and I, both are kind of ultimately pretty optimistic people. But it certainly there's moments of human connection in that I think are really, you know, particularly the end of a couple of the episodes that are really triumphant and really sort of cathartic. And that was really important to us as well.
So if the first two seasons were Obama era, and this is a sort of coming out of the last 15 months, was there simply no Trump era version of the show? And what does that mean?
Oh, man, maybe that dude wasn't good for our creative process. y'all never forget, man. Like this is real, man, because it's exactly 4 years ago, right? So the day Trump got elected. Man, I'm so glad to have not talked about Trump for so long. It's crazy. I really haven't thought about him for a while. But the day Trump got elected, so we went out. It was crazy, right? We went out drinking, and then the next day we were shooting Master None, and it happened to be an episode I was directing. And of course it's like a 7 or 8 a.m. call or whatever, early in the morning, and this episode called Religion, and I'm not even joking. We were all kind of. It seemed like a catastrophic moment in American history, which it kind of was. And people were kind of bummed out on set. And, you know, one of the first scenes up was a scene that didn't end up even making the episode, but it was a flashback to a younger version of Dev post 9/11. And he was like walking across the street, and there's a guy in a car who leans out the window and says, "Hurry up, terrorist," to Dev. Like it was like a moment of racism, like which again, we depicted in the show occasionally. And this is the morning after Trump's elected. And I'm not joking. This actor's doing, you know, Hurry Up Terrorist, already very fraught. It's very difficult. And he's not doing it angrily enough. So I'm like, can you do it more racist? I was like, can you do it angry? Like, that was like, that was my job the morning after Trump got elected. And it was like, this is just too much, man. So maybe subconsciously we put a pin in the show, because it was like, man, this is not a good time. But yeah, we just kind of skipped that over. We skipped over that regime.
Yeah, well, looking forward, we're now obviously in the Biden regime, and you have this new season, obviously, with the subtitle. But I wonder, you know, as you have ideas that didn't make it in, and as the country is starting to open back up with vaccines, et cetera, you know, do you know what a next season looks like? Will you continue with the subtitle? Will there ever be a return to what the tone and the way it was shot in seasons 1 and 2, et cetera?
Yeah, I just wouldn't rule anything out. You know, I just wouldn't rule anything out. I think, you know, it's kind of what I said earlier, which is like, all we have is our instincts and what we're most excited about. You know, I think that's what's fun about being creative, right? Is like, you wake up one morning, it's like, wait, we should do this kind of album, right? That's the fun. Can you imagine how fun that is if you're like in Radiohead or whatever, or like if you're Kanye or the Beatles or whatever? It's like, man, some of these albums are way different, right? That's the fun of it, right? That's the fun of it. It's like, can I destroy people's expectations and like, you know, just do something completely different and do it well? Like, that's the hope, right? So that's the hope. So, you know, look, it's I think the show scratches a certain itch for us, which is to be challenging and to sort of, you know, be ambitious. And so I don't think we'll ever do a season that's not ambitious in some way and that has a lot of different definitions. But I would never rule it out. I think, you know, a joke we used to make a long time ago, seasons 1 and 2, is like, It would be, you know, it'd be really interesting to see the show that Alan Aziz make when we're 65, right? That, like, well, then we'll have different stuff to say. Like, I don't know if it'll be interesting, but it'll certainly be different, and it'll be like a totally different thing. But I also do, you know, again, feel lucky that we're able to do a season with a subtitle, right? That's a little different. That centers a different character and has a slightly different tone, and so that is that I love, and that I think is really cool, and is like, oh wow, it's a different look, and hopefully, you know, people get on board.
Yeah, and just because I have to ask, you know, will you submit this as a comedy or a drama series for awards consideration?
I don't know if this is a spoiler, but yeah, I believe we're submitting it as a comedy. Yeah, so. Award spoiler. I don't know if people care about that, but yeah, sure.
I think there are people in our industry that care deeply.
Yeah,
about
that's
that,
true. That's
that are
true.
Paid to care.
I got
to
remember who I'm talking to. This is not a general population podcast. This is people in the know who care. So yes, for the Hollywood Reporter, we're submitting this comedy. Please vote for Master of None.
Well, I mean, my understanding,
comedy category.
My understanding is that it's a totally different level of Suras to have to change categories. So once you guys are already a comedy, it's easier to stay a comedy than to suddenly become a drama, right?
I think so. I think there's comedic elements in the show. I mean, I think it's like, look, it's probably a lot funnier than most of the drama. So let's put it in the comedy category. So yeah. And by the way, like, you know, while we're on the topic, it's like, we really hope, you know, Naomi and Lena get recognized, because we really feel like they do tremendous, tremendous work. So I think Lena's in the lead actress category, and Naomi's in the supporting actress. So yeah, all comedy across the board, and yeah.
And yet the episode I want to at least touch on is the one where Naomi is the front and center part of the episode, which is the fourth episode, which is the episode that you alluded to earlier with the fertility drama in it. When did that episode become something that you were kind of building the season toward and around?
Very early on. And it was kind of, you know, we were pitching ideas for what, you know, what were the sort of events that would separate them, and then what would they possibly do on their own, these characters. And then I think, you know, having Naomi in the fold, you know, sort of highlighted that episode a little more. And then we just kind of started building. And again, I think Aziz did a lot of research and talked to a lot of people. And what we realized when we first started broaching this topic was how vastly widespread this topic is, and how it hasn't been covered very much in fictional works. And it is everywhere, you know. And maybe that's the age I'm at now, but I talk about it with my friends, and so many people in my life are going through this kind of process. And whether you're single, or whether you're in a couple, whether you're just dating, or whether you're in a queer relationship, or, you know, whatever your personal sort of characteristics are, like, the fertility situation is just really, really, really common. And so, you know, using that as a jumping off point and then talking to people. You know, there are people on our crew who experience some version of this, and we talk to them, and using some of these sort of personal experiences and sort of story turns here and there. Like, you know, we felt like gave the episode something of a, I don't know, there's just something really emotional about it. And then that's the best way I can put it, where you feel like you're put through the ringer. And I had multiple people of all kinds, of all stripes, you know, directors and actors and people who are not in the industry, just email me separately saying, boy, at the end of episode 4, I collapse in a puddle of tears, right? It was because it's just such a process, and Naomi delivers such a tour de force performance and the writing direction, all of it. But it's just like, you feel like you're in that process. You feel like you're just with her on this journey. And by the end, I won't reveal what happens, but it's just like, you're ready to have an emotional sort of cathartic experience. And again, that's a testament to, you know, all the folks who worked on it, but yeah.
And you mentioned the UK and you mentioned the need to scout. First of all, why did you shoot in the UK? And then tell us about the casting of the house, because obviously the farmhouse is basically the third character this season.
It's beautiful. And I'll let you in. Well, first of all, it's because Aziz is living in London, so we shot in London. So that was not like, but by the way, I mean, beautiful countryside there that ended up being incredibly, you know, again, like you said, another character in the show, like the farmhouse that we shot at, you know, I will let people in on a little secret for those of you with eagle eyes. I don't think anyone's been able to tell this yet because everyone thinks it's a real house because it's so well done. But that's Amy Williams, our production designer. That's a stage for the vast majority of it. And I almost hesitate to even say that because it's so well done and it looks so perfect. But it is another character. I mean, and there's, as we mentioned before, these Ozu pillow shots of just the house. I mean, we have so many shots of just the house, the empty rooms, what that connotes, and you know, just a shot of the sink or a shot of the fireplace or a shot of the teddy bear room or any of those things, you know. But that is work from Amy Williams, who has worked on every season of this show and every movie or show I've ever worked on, as she's worked on, and so she's brilliant. But that the farm itself, there was something also very interesting to us about seeing these two characters, these two specific women in this context. You just, for whatever reason, we don't see it that much. This couple talking about American Girl dolls being black or not, and like, you know, that and then the seeing it against this beautiful sort of idyllic green, these green fields and rolling hills and chickens and horses and sheep. And yeah, there was something magical about that. And then you add the Jesse Norman music, the opera, and all, you know, to me, all of those layers, you know, becoming this final product, like it was something very specific and something we hadn't seen before. And so that was a big part of it for us.
Starting to wrap up here, you know, I want to talk about some of the other stuff that you've got going on. You're reteaming with Maya Rudolph, whom you worked with on Forever, and Matt Hubbard for a comedy at Apple, where you already have serve as an exec producer on Little America. Talk a little bit about what we can expect from the Maya Rudolph comedy and what you just cast MJ Rodriguez in that, who's one of my favorites from Pose.
Yeah, how exciting, man. Maya and MJ together. This is incredible. I'm just really excited. Already, yeah. It's pretty great duo already to set the show up around. But so speaking of all the sort of tonal shifts and the tonal shifts of the country, this one's going to be fun. It's fun and funny. It's a comedy. And it's like, this is one you could turn on and just be like, I'm enjoying myself. And it's just, you know, straight up comedy. You know, hopefully not in a sort of, not in an insipid or unthoughtful way, but a comedy that again is just fun to watch, straight up fun to watch and talk about, and you know, there's an element to it also that has a relevance because in the show Maya plays a woman who gets divorced from her husband and inherits $87 billion. Definitely not very topical, right? But so there is an element of certainly class inequality in the show that we are addressing. But you know, besides that, it is one of the sort of warm ensemble comedy shows that I've worked on in the past and that Matt's worked on in the past. You know, he worked on 30 Rock, I worked on Parks and Rec, and so that's in our DNA. It's in our bones, and so this one's kind of in that vein.
And there's no chance that when we come back to this in 2 years that it's going to turn out to be a darker or more bittersweet comedy than you think it is right now.
No promises. MJ only in a dark. It's gonna look like a Kurosawa film starring MJ. No, you never know, man. You never know. I'm not. No promises.
I would also watch MJ in a tour de force. So that's,
yeah, exactly. You know. By the way, can you imagine how great that would be? I'd watch her Master Nunzi. And then little America, you know, we're working on scripts for season two, and we have some great ones written, and we're hoping to shoot that this year. Again, some COVID issues, of course, with that show, because it's, you know, a very challenging show to make because there's no standing sets. It's an anthology, and you have an all new cast for every show and for every episode. But we're doing it really enjoying that. And Sean Hader is our showrunner on that, and she just had this movie Coda at Sundance, which killed. And so, you know, we're so excited to have Sean still working on the show and helping us on that one. So yeah, it's we're excited about that. By the way, like, I was surprised, like, that Little America got nominated for a BAFTA. I was like, BAFTA like nominates American shows? I was like, I didn't even realize that they could do that. And it's like, but it was so funny because it was like best international show. I was like, oh shit, Little America is an international show to them. So that was kind of cool. We were kind of fun. The EPs on that show, we have a text thread. We're like, oh, it's cool. Like, a BAFTA is not something you expect to get nominated for when you make an American show. So we're like, that's truly the most international show in the world. It's characters from all over the world. So.
And we're talking about sort of pre-production on things, and this third season of Master of None was one where you didn't do that. Was secrecy intended, or was that just something that happened?
Yeah, I think we kind of wanted to keep it under wraps. We kind of thought it was kind of cooler, and was just like, it's such a pivot, and it's such a thing where it's like, I don't know. It's like, all apologies to the press and you guys doing your job. It was like, we just thought this one would be kind of fun to just be like, let's keep it under wraps and like shoot it. And I don't know. There's a lot of people who do it that way, which is, and it's kind of cool. Like, we found that kind of to be an interesting approach. And you know, I don't think it's for everything. You know, I think for some things it's like, let's have a whole ramp up. Let's announce every casting. Let's announce MJ, right? Let's, you know, but for this season of Master, I think it was like, yeah, this felt like the right thing to do for this one.
Yeah. Well, we do like to wrap every episode, all these interviews with the same question. What are you watching and enjoying right now?
Wow, it's a good one. I watched Mayor of Easttown last night. I just started that. So I felt like everyone in my life was watching it, so I had to watch it. But yeah, so we're getting started on that one. It's always interesting to see Kate Winslet eat food in every shot. This is, again, I'm a bad guy to ask this, or maybe I'm a good guy. Daniel knows. It's like, I'm just watching old movies. So it's like, I watch this weird Robert Altman movie that like is, but like, yeah, I'm like trying to keep up. Let's see, what else have I been watching? Oh, I've been, you know, this is a shameless plug, but I was watching Dave season two is coming out. My girlfriend is on that show, and it's an amazing show. I can't wait. I've seen some of the stuff that they've kind of been shooting for season two. I think it's gonna be really interesting and great, so I'm excited about that show, which comes out I think soon after Master. So
indeed. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was fun talking to you guys.
Season three of Master of None premieres Sunday, May 23rd on Netflix.
Number five.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner. This week's major new launches are Master of None on Netflix, The Bite on Spectrum Originals, MODOK on Hulu, and In Treatment on HBO. Dan, what you got?
We should add first that Amazon's Solos, which premieres on Friday, had an embargo of not just morning of premiere, which would be midnight and is fairly common, but actually into the morning of premiere, specifically after the time that this podcast goes up. So, hey, we're nothing but good partners to Amazon, so no review. Among things that actually do want review consideration, even if you haven't necessarily heard of them, The Bite is a Spectrum's original drama. You might know Spectrum originals from such shows as The Mad About You Revival and that show with Gabrielle Union and Jessica Alba that aired on Fox at some point, LA's Finest, I believe. So The Bite is the latest thing that you can get on demand on Spectrum, but only if you have Spectrum. And somewhat amusingly, it's from former podcast guests, The Kings, the creators of The Good Fight and Good Wife. And yeah, so a little bit funny to have a show from Robert and Michelle King that lots of people don't know exists. But it's a funny little show. It is a pandemic shot zombie COVID dramedy. It is a fairly wacky comedy in the vein of Brain Dead, which some people will remember as the summer, basically people in Washington have brainworms comedy that the Kings did a couple years ago that I found really uneven, but also in retrospect feels like it was probably very, very, very prescient. The Bite is interesting because it's like those strange shows that premiered last April and May where they shot everything so the characters were yelling into Zoom screens because they couldn't share screens together. So it's Audra McDonald and Taylor Schilling as two very different women. One is a doctor. The other one is a dominatrix who live in the same Hell's Kitchen apartment building. And they begin to realize separately, but then together, that there's a new strain of COVID that can be transmitted by bite and is turning people into something that would be a lot like zombies, except no one wants to use the Z word. It is semi-amusing at times. And I would say that the third and fourth episodes, which steer the most into very, very silly, wacky comedy, are quite entertaining because I would say the third and fourth episodes reminded me a lot of, among other things, Santa Clarita Diet, an underrated Netflix show that that I thought did a good job of being a zombie suburban satire. This is a different kind of satire. Then the show, though, in the fifth and sixth episodes makes a kind of big mistake and decides to take its premise much more seriously than I think it has any ability to sustain. So it's interesting seeing how they're handling all the COVID stuff, and also interesting that this is a COVID show that's coming back after production has resumed on more normal COVID protocol shows for months. This is very much more in the vein of something like NBC's Connecting or Freeform's Love in the Time of Corona. Do you remember that those shows exist?
I remember that Love in the Time of Corona exists because Freeform sent out a beautiful plant that I still have.
I did not get that plant, unfortunately, but I did watch four or five episodes of Love in the Time of Corona, which was not very good. But
that's four or five more than I watched.
It's four or five more than I suspect most people watched. But a lot of those shows at that time were doing funny things where, okay, so no one could be on screen together, but then if you cast people's spouses, that was a way around it. So you get to have here a lot of Broadway stars, and you get to find out who their real-life spouses are. So Stephen Pasquale is playing a CDC doctor, and he has all of his scenes with Philippa Sue. And Philippa Sue, who people will know from Hamilton, of course, happens to be his wife. Well, how nice that they can share scenes together. How nice that Audra McDonald's husband can share scenes with her. How nice that Michael Urie and his husband get to be in scenes together. So that's kind of a funny thing about it. But anyway, it is not a wholly successful show, but now you at least know it exists. And when anyone tells you it exists, you've heard of it. MODOK, which is on Hulu, is a lot like Hulu trying to have its own version of HBO Max's Harley Quinn. So it's kind of taking a snarky, deep dive, animated comic look at a second tier, or in this case probably a fourth or fifth tier comic villain, with snarky insider humor and lots of references to other Marvel properties that are very, 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 very marginal. And that's kind of funny. It is not as good as Harley Quinn, which I think is a terrific show, but it's amusing. It comes from the same studio that does Robot Chicken, and that is what the augmented puppetry effect looks a lot like. There's a lot of references around pop culture, a whole episode built around a Third Eye Blind concert, for example. So I know you're a big Third Eye Blind fan, Leslie.
Sure.
I don't know. I thought I'd take a swing at that just in case you happen to be a stealth closet Third Eye Blind fan.
I think I know the same one song everybody else knows.
I believe there's actually a second single that is featured in the episode beyond just Semi-Charmed Kind of Life. So, Patton Oswalt is the co-creator on the show. He's very, very, very funny as the main character, who's basically a gigantic head slash brain in a robo suit. Lots of very, very good voices are also in it. Melissa Fumero, Amy Garcia, John Hamm plays Tony Stark slash Iron Man. You have Nathan Fillion as Alan Sepinwall's favorite superhero, Wonder Man, in at least one episode. It doesn't add up in the kind of human and emotional way that Harley Quinn does, but it's amusing. Not bad. It won't cause you pain.
And this is the last Marvel show from Jeff Loeb, right?
I believe so. Yes, I believe that everything else has been triaged out of existence. And that is...
Including the rest of the shows that MODOK was picked up with, right? Because as I remember, it was four animated shows and two specials, all of which kind of poked fun at the original Netflix Marvel model. And I think this might be the last one.
And it's, again...
Or the only one to survive.
It's not bad, and I do think comic fans are going to be amused by it. Seriously, if you are a Robot Chicken fan, give it a look. I suspect you'll like it. I mean, Robot Chicken is a show that I like and that makes me laugh. I never find it to be cumulatively hugely effective, but this is a lot like that, and that's fine.
And I think I stand corrected. I think there's still a Hitmonkey animated show coming as part of that Marvel Hulu deal, but I don't know for sure. It's been a long time since I've checked in on that. So let us know. Let us know on social media, Marvel people.
Going over to more dramatic things. HBO has the return of In Treatment. People will remember, of course, that In Treatment was based on an Israeli format and featured Gabriel Byrne and won Emmys for Glenn Turman and Diane Wiest, if memory serves. And the new version has none of those people. It is instead based around Uzo Aduba, who plays a Los Angeles area, the Baldwin Hills neighborhood in particular, therapist. And basically the premise is the show airs four nights a week. Each night has a half hour episode based around a different therapy session. And the show remains primarily a phenomenal acting showcase. Uzo Aduba is very good. The standouts among her patients, Anthony Ramos is fantastic as a patient who has to Skype or stream in to talk to her. Some people will be bothered by not having them in the same room. To my mind, this is very reflective of a therapy experience during COVID pandemic. So,
and that's also reflective of why HBO brought the show back, because it's easier to produce during a pandemic.
It is such an easy to produce pandemic show. Just about every episode is one or two people in a room talking to each other, usually at a fairly respectful distance. It is the mother of all COVID shows. And you get, you know, four nights a week of programming out of it. So Anthony Ramos is the star. Probably John Benjamin Hickey is also terrific. I thought there were a lot of cliches that came out of his arc, which involves a white collar criminal who basically needs the main character's sign off for his early release. But he is remarkable. And some of the other ones feel like the storylines feel like they're going to get better as they go along. I've seen 4 weeks worth of stories for this, so I had to watch 16 episodes to review it, which is a lot. But
did you feel like you were in treatment, Dan?
At times, except not so much getting healed or anything, but you know, that's okay. But no, lots of great acting. And the thing that I've always found about the show is that you really, after a week or two, can start saying, okay, I'm just not gonna watch certain storylines because they aren't required to watch. You can figure out what's happening if you happen to say skip, you know, every Wednesday's episode. Fairly easy. And I find that to be a very convenient thing about the show. So I would definitely recommend checking out the Anthony Ramos episodes. Those are, I believe they're gonna be the Sunday episodes. They're the first episode of each week, and they're great. I think there's a lot to recommend really in all of the main episodes. I got a little tired of the episodes that were focusing just on Uzo Aduba's character. I think that she's great in the episodes with other characters, but maybe a little less exciting on her own. But this is a very timely show on many levels, and I think it has a lot of value in that.
Yeah, speaking of In Treatment, we will be joined by the showrunners for the HBO revival on next week's episode.
And last for this week's Critics Corner Reviews is the show that you already heard our showrunner spotlight for in the last segment with Alan Yang. That would be the return of Master of None. And as you heard Alan say and explain, it's a very, different show this season. It really is. And I think it's important to kind of know that up front. And I think a lot of how you respond to the show is going to be determined by whether the thing that's interesting to you about the show previously was basically Aziz Ansari cracking wise and the various different food porn subplots, or were you interested in kind of the relationship exploration side of it? Because this is much more towards that. And I think that it means that the tone is different. I would say it is a darker tone. I would say it is often a more melancholy tone, but this was all discussed in our conversation with Alan. But I do think that Naomi Ackie is fantastic. She is the new face in this because Lena Waithe was, of course, in previous seasons as Denise. And so the first couple episodes, a little bit hit and miss. Third episode, I could have done without it entirely, but it's only 30 minutes. And the fourth episode, to me, was tremendous and another one of those episodes that I'm already saying is guaranteed to be in a best episodes of the year list at the end of the year. It is primarily focused on Naomi Ackie's character and her fertility drama, and it is just a beautiful, nearly full hour of TV. And that one in particular, I recommend extremely highly. And the fifth episode, I also thought was extremely good. I thought it tied things together well and did things to make the first two episodes better for me. So stick with it is what I'm telling people is you might find the first couple episodes off-putting because it's not the show that you watched before. And it's not, you just have to know that. But I think that the last two episodes make it really totally worthwhile, especially the fourth one. But the fifth one also has highlights as well. So just, you know, for the 30th or 40th time, probably even more if you include the interview with Alan, it is not the same show it was when it was about Aziz Ansari's character and his various romantic travails in New York City. Don't expect it to be, and meet it on its own terms. And I think it's worthwhile. So that is this week's Critics Corner.
And that feels like a good place to wrap things up. For more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to THR's Now See This newsletter. Thank you for listening to TV's Top 5, the Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. We'll be back next week when we will be joined by not only the In Treatment showrunners, but as well as a surprise guest that we could not be more excited about. See what I did there,
Dan? Once again, you're implying it's either Matthew Perry or the monkey, and it is neither of those two people. I do not want our listeners to be disappointed very much. Anyway, be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, please rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. Doesn't take much time, but it really does improve our placement in different lists on different services. We're always happy to chat with you guys on the Twitter. Let us know what you liked, what you didn't like,
what you'd like to hear going forward.
Exactly. What we blew entirely, all of that stuff. But if you have questions for future podcasts, and I think next week might be a decent week for a mailbag segment, perhaps a what questions do you have coming out of upfronts or something to that effect, you can email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.